You're listening to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience, with your hosts Willie Hassel and Lynn Nickerson on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Good evening and welcome once again to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience. I am your host, Willie Hassel, your gatekeeper to the dark side, your guide to the realm of the unknown, the unseen, the unthinkable. And hey, she's the always lovely, she's the mystical, she's the mysterious. And she is Lynn Nickerson.
Well, good evening, Willie. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Good, just fine. I'm really anxious to talk to our friend over in the UK.
Yes. It's been a long time since we've gone
across
the pond, isn't it?
Yeah, it makes them stay up late.
I know it.
5 hour difference. They're very brave.
And we're
most gracious.
We really appreciate that,
too.
So tonight on Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience, we are happy to have joining us Christian Jensen Romer. Christian has been studying the paranormal for nearly 40 years and has contributed to over a dozen different TV shows, including shows like Most Haunted and Ghost Hunters. CJ is an active member of the Society for Psychical Research and is also an active secretary for the Association for Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena. Hey, I did that right. Let's welcome to the show tonight, Christian Jensen Romer. CJ, welcome to the show.
Good evening.
Hello.
Welcome.
Good evening. I was going to pretend for a moment that I'd fallen asleep, but I thought that wouldn't be very funny. So it's the witching hour here now. It's the middle of the night, and I'm looking around somewhat nervously, but nothing has manifested so far. So it's a strange career, ghost hunting, isn't it?
Well, let's just start there. Is your place haunted, CJ?
Sadly not. I live in a 19th century little cottage in a terraced road next to a large college building, which is in the Victorian Gothic style.
Oh, it looks lovely. Sounds lovely.
Bit spooky, but I share it with three cats, and I'm pretty sure that if there were any ghosts here, they would let me know.
yeah, they would.
They'd be staring, I'm sure. So you were on both Most Haunted and Ghost Hunters, but did you have your own TV series, or you participated for a while?
I don't know who gave you that bio. I mean, to start with, I've been ghost hunting for 40 years. I'm only 48, so I would have started very young.
Oh, dear.
I had my first experience when I was 8 years old, so I suppose you could say it's been 40 years. But, yeah, no, I've never had a TV series. I'm not interesting enough. But I was the researcher on Most Haunted for both Hanrahan Media, who did the live shows in the UK, and then for Antics, who did the series.
Oh.
And so I tended to crop up from time to time, and it's funny because every time you see me on it, I've got a different subtitle. CJ Romer, parapsychologist. CJ Romer, historian. CJ Romer, expert. They couldn't decide on a single thing to call me, so every week I was something different.
Man of many hats.
I think actually that just the creative imaginations of TV producers, which know no bounds when they're trying to find some way to make you sound more interesting than you are. And I'm not very interested.
So on February 18th, you're going to be on this live streaming event, and you're going to be talking about the Borley Rectory. And so we want to talk a little bit about the history of that. Now, you used to live in that area about 12 miles from the area, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I grew up in Bury St. Edmunds just down the road, and it's hard to imagine the landscape if you haven't been out there. But, I mean, it is very similar to New England. There's sunken lanes as you come out down towards Long Melford and Foxearth, and then you come to a small area. You go up a hill, down across a river valley, up a hill the other side. And as you come up to the top of the hill, there's a church on the corner in front of you. And it's a flint church, the East Anglian style, a stone church. Probably dates back to the 13th century. So, you know, probably about 1230, I would guess, looking at it, 1250 maybe.
Okay.
But quite old by English standards.
Yeah.
Not ancient, but,
no.
but old. Older than anything, I suppose, you get much in America, apart from Native American ruins.
Mm.
I
yeah, I read somewhere where one of those naves went back to the 12th century and that the monastery supposedly was the 13th, but they seem to be a little bit earlier than that, or later than that,
yeah.
actually.
Yeah, I mean,
they're not...
I think what was there was something called a chapter house, which is... if you imagine a monastery as being the main place where the monks are, then you might have a chapter house, which is a small dwelling where there may be a few monks or nuns. And there's possibly there was a chapter house there, because I can't find any evidence of a monastery at Bury.
Okay.
At Bures, B-U-R-E-S. Yes. At Clare, definitely a very famous one. All the way around, Bury St. Edmunds was renowned for its monks. I mean, basically, East Anglia was crawling with monks and nuns, it seems, in the Middle Ages. But Bury, devoid of monkey business. Sorry, that was
You know, but, I didn't realize that sometimes the monks and the nuns might have been housed in the same enclave of buildings. Yes. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Well, some of the orders had combined houses, and the reason for that was, I mean, Etheldreda, who founded a lot of the East Anglian monasteries, was very much in favour of them, because she believed that having monks and nuns in the same building allowed them to live more normally.
Yeah.
And you'd also have lay brothers who would take monastic vows, but would actually still be part of the community, and were not actually full monks. So chastity, I'm not sure. I don't believe they followed even chastity. I think they followed, well, celibacy they didn't follow. Chastity they did. They stayed faithful to their wives. But I don't think lay brothers were required to be celibate. So it's all very complicated. And by the time that we usually think about the great orders, the Cluniacs, the Cistercians, and all those, you know, it's much more normal to have no nuns. Nuns firmly kept away from monks.
Yeah. All right. So the rectory, the Bury Rectory, had been erected about 1862, and it was built over ground that was believed to be haunted to begin with in that area.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. What I know from the village folklore is that for centuries there have been stories, supposedly. I mean, I've never seen any evidence of it, but for centuries there have been folklore that there was a nun who haunted the area where the rectory was built.
Mm.
And the bull who built the rectory, he had a summer house built at one end, and the reason was purportedly so that he could watch the ghost of the nun walking in the grounds. Now, the bulls were... The bulls still are. There are still bulls in Suffolk, and they are strong-headed and slightly eccentric characters. But I had the pleasure of knowing one. Whether it was a direct relative, I don't know. But I do know people called Bull in Suffolk who are quite prominent. And, you know, to this day, they're slightly colourful. When he built the rectory, it was a huge, rambling house. And it's I can't remember how many bedrooms. Is it 13 bedrooms? It's something unfeasible like that. It was impossible to heat. They couldn't keep enough staff. And I told you last night when we spoke briefly that my grandmother used to have a job of delivering lemonade. Mm-hmm. Now, this was during the First World War, in the days when they would go out in a pony trap and ride out there with horses and pull the lemonade bottles. And this was Cod's lemonade. Cod's lemonade was best known because it came in a bottle with a glass marble, and the gas in the lemonade would hold the marble in place. I mean, have you ever seen a bottle with a marble in the neck? No,
no, I haven't.
No, well, we used to have them. They were very, very common. And Cod, spelt C-O-D-D-S, they produced the Wallop range of lemonade. So one of the origins suggested for Cod's Wallop is their lemonade, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Do you use the word Cod's Wallop?
No.
No?
Mm-mm.
It's a word used in England to mean something of little value or something that's nonsense. And it may have originated from the word for lemonade. Anyway, it doesn't matter. She was taking the lemonade out there to the rectory. And I said, "Did you see any ghosts?" And she looked at me as if I was mad and said, "I never saw any ghosts. They were a bit weird, though. What, the daughters, you know, they used to look at me funny." And I said, "Oh, really?" And she said, "Well, they didn't know me. I was a stranger." And I thought, well, yeah, they probably thought you were... what you were up to when you were out there handing out putting the lemonade on the doorstep. But I said to her, "So what was the house like?" And she said, "No ghosts, it stank." "What? It smelt bad. The drains were bad." "Really?" She said, "In the summer, Bury Rectory was noted for its bad drains."
Wow.
And she said, "In the winter, the house was always damp." And she said, "It was the kind of building that nobody would want to live in."
Wow.
Well, she knew, you know, my grandmother, who lived to be 96, but was born in 1900, she lived 39 years in the vicinity, so she knew the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think she was ever invited inside more than further than the doorway to hand over the lemonade. But, you know, that was the impression she had. A large, rambling rectory that wasn't particularly comfortable or pleasant as a place to live.
No, it's nice that you've got that little familial connection. But...
Well, my mother, as a girl, played up there. And she knew the house, but again, she was never invited in. So it's so frustrating because, you know, I show them photos and say, do you remember? And they say, no, but it was always in the newspaper. Yeah, it was always, when I was growing up, Mum said, it was always in the newspaper.
That there was something happening.
It burnt down when she was just 10 years old. So.
Well, the thing was that they talked about having all kinds of manifestations throughout the years, and then sort of at the end of it, once the rectory had burnt, and then it was demolished, like in 1944, people started denying that there was any activity at all. Well, go ahead.
There's a reason for that, which is basically Harry Price. You know Harry Price, the great British ghost hunter?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Harry was never frightened of a bit of publicity, was he? This is the man. He made me look shameless. And, I mean, I would definitely like to do some of the things he did. My favourite one was he went up a mountain, in Germany, and recited a spell designed to turn a goat into a handsome young maiden.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I wonder how that worked.
I mean, this seems an entirely perfectly rational and normal thing to do. He took with him Professor C.E.M. Joad, who was a distinguished Oxford philosopher, one of the great public intellectuals of his age. He was one of the most famous and respectable men.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of them climbed a mountain, and they went up there on Walpurgis Night, the night when the devil and the witches are meant to dance on top of the mountain. And they did a spell, century-old spell they'd found in a grimoire.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what?
What happened? The goat died.
It didn't turn into anything. No, it was very disappointing. They had pretty girls dancing around in diaphanous robes. They had a goat looking somewhat bewildered. They had half the world's press there watching them. And to no one's amazement, absolutely nothing happened.
Well, you know,
the goat remained a goat.
I was looking up some of the history of the Borley Rectory in a book written by Nandor Fodor. And he makes a comment about Harry Price. And he said, I did not like him because he was a very difficult man to like. He was intensely selfish, jealous, and intent on his own glory at all cost. He said, but these weaknesses of his character do not detract from his reputation as an honest investigator and ruthless exposure of frauds. Pretty much what you told us last night, that he was a bit of a jerk, but he was probably a good investigator.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the thing is that Nandor was a superb investigator and a great psychoanalyst, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he's completely right here. I mean, the attacks after his death, what happened was they discovered that Price, he had a tendency to nick books from libraries and never give them back.
Oh.
And he eventually donated all of his library, which was a fantastic collection.
Well, that's great.
It's now at Senate House at the University of London. And he shared his own books quite happily. But his book plates made claim to the fact that he was Ex Libris Harry Price, and it had the address of a hall, a sort of noble family's home, where there was indeed a Price family on the borders of Wales. But unfortunately, Harry had no connection to that family whatsoever. He was just trying to make it sound like he had an aristocratic connection, whereas in reality, he came from very humble roots. It's a terrible thing to do, maybe, to lie about one's past and pretend one's some kind of, you know, high-up type when you're not. I actually very sympathetic to Harry there. Go on, sorry.
He had, it wasn't appreciated that he had given the designation of most haunted to the Borley Rectory, and Nandor Fodor was saying that it was just really a result of his narcissism. But he said that there was supposedly another most haunted place not too far away. I bet it was Bellachan House? Bellachan in Berthshire?
Oh, Bellachan, that's in Scotland. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The haunting of Bee House.
So
yeah.
Harry kind of hijacked that title to make himself look good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Bee House case had happened about 30 or 40 years before at the turn of the century. And indeed, the people involved in that were even more dodgy. constants. But I mean, that was the Society for Psychical Research. They published their investigation of it as the Haunting of Bee House. And what they did was they hired this Scottish hunting lodge that was supposedly haunted, and they sent a bunch of investigators up there who really were a bit amateurish about what they did.
Mm-hmm.
But they stayed in the house and recorded all the things they heard. And they published a very good book about it, The Haunting of Bee House, and argued from that yes, there was a real such a thing as ghosts. And, I mean, you know, it was the very early days of psychic investigation. No one really knew what they were doing. But with Harry, that's actually quite interesting, because all the people involved in Bee House were lords and ladies and peers of the realm.
Mm-hmm.
They were the aristocracy. And the Society for Psychical Research in those days was composed of the aristocracy. So when Harry, who was a, you know, very much a working class character, came along, there were working class characters in the SPR, but they were few and far between. And Harry therefore embroidered his own pedigree because he was surrounded by snobs.
Yeah.
And so therefore, to get anywhere, you know, he just kind of hinted that he was one of them. And who can blame him? I mean, I detest snobs with a passion, and I don't think.
Oh, truly.
This is one of the things that they, after he died, people found these things where he'd lied and said, well, look, he pretended to be more than he was. He was just a humble man, but he pretended he was from an aristocratic kind of or gentry background. But yeah, I think there was a reason why he did that.
Well, it's certainly, yeah, he's got a good intellect, so he shouldn't be, you know, discredited.
Yeah.
Just because of his status.
Yeah.
But after the go ahead.
Have you read his book, The Most Haunted House in England?
No, I haven't, no.
Ah, I've got a copy here, actually. I was told by people in the SPR that it was a load of rubbish, and I was told by psychic investigators for 20 years that it was really not worth reading. It was complete crap, and, you know, it was one of those books best left alone. And I picked up a copy, quite by chance. I found one in the second-hand bookshop, and so I bought it. And one night I opened it and I was fascinated, and I read it through and I learned so much. And I think he was one of the great ghost hunters. And I think it's a superb book.
Good.
And I encourage everyone to actually read it. Yeah. It's a well-written, concise, clear and intelligent book.
Well, when Harry...
I wish I was that clever.
Well, when Harry moved in, he was invited to visit the newspaper while the Foysters were there. He had been invited to at least visit the place because of the claims of all the spirit activity. And then when the Foysters moved out, he moved in for approximately 14 months or at least a year anyway. And he reported supposedly over 2,000 paranormal phenomena. And quite a variety of things happened. So what Mary Ann Foyster experienced, was that ever really debunked?
There's a book which does a pretty good... Well, again, it doesn't really debunk the phenomena. What it does is calls her everything up under the sun, up to and including... Well, I'm not going to repeat libelous claims. But yeah, it's called The Widow of Borley. It's by Robert Wood.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a rare book now. But, I mean, it throws... It's vile, actually, and it's attacks on her. I mean, if it's true, there was almost nothing she was not capable of. She certainly was having affairs left, right, and centre while she was in Borley.
Marianne Foyster, the wife of the Reverend. Foyster, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And her husband was an elderly, frail, and sick man who wasn't so bright. She moved her lover, Francis Dahls, into the cottage at the bottom of the garden. And, I mean, yeah, if you read Robert Wood's book, he makes a very strong case that Marianne was as honest as the day is short in December. She was, you know, completely and utterly crooked, if you believe him. Now, I've spoken to her son, who knew her, obviously, her adopted son, Vince O'Neill. He's a great guy, and I find it hard to believe that she was as portrayed, but I don't know. I never knew her. I don't know anybody who knew her.
Well, other than what Mary...
The important thing is, it doesn't rest on Marianne. If it only rested on her, Borley would have been forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
But during the Balls... The book, let's go through it quickly. So you start off from 1862 through to the early 1900s, about 1910, the Ball family, including two Harry Balls, who are both reverends, and sisters, live in the house. Their sisters and then, you know, the aunts and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So they live in the house, and they occupy it, and they are... running the church across the road. They are the reverend of the parish. the two Harrys, Henry and Harry.
Henry and Harry, yeah.
Henry and Harry. After they die off, the sisters move away just down the road to Long Melford, which is about half an hour's walk across the fields. It's not far at all. Okay, at that point, Ethel and Guy Smith move in, is that right?
Mm-hmm, I think right, so. Guy Smith, yep.
And when they move in, they start to experience the hauntings.
And they only stay a year.
Yeah, and the vicar starts to record, you know, he starts again to write a book recording the so-called goblins, as he calls it. And his wife panics and contacts the newspaper, who then say, well, you should ask the Society for Psychical Research or somebody. But then they have this brilliant idea because the SPR is a bit sniffy about it. Because this is at a time when, you know, petrol is quite expensive and hard to get between the wars. Mm-hmm. Rationing's not that far behind. And it's a really, really difficult part of Suffolk to get to. Right, I'm going home to see my parents in Bury tomorrow.
Oh.
And from where I am on the other side, yeah, I'll be 12 miles from Borley tomorrow.
Oh, jeez.
But to get there from where I am at the moment would be 7.5 hours on a coach or 6 hours on a train. And that's nowadays.
Yeah, that's a distance.
It's only 90 miles from London, but it's really hard to get there because the roads are bad, the communications aren't great. I mean, we can drive there in about 3.5-4 hours. But if you imagine in the 1930s, it was a whole further level of rural isolation.
Mm.
So people just weren't keen on going out there. Right, so they sent out this ghost hunter, Harry Price, and he gets involved at that point. But there's already a history of haunting going back for 30-odd years at least before Harry arrives on the scene. Then Marianne turns up, and Marianne, of course, famously brings a whole new level of activity.
Yeah.
But Harry didn't trust her. Harry couldn't stand her, in fact, from what I remember. He wanted nothing to do with her and was convinced she was faking. And she was extremely sharp about him. The two of them, they were both highly, highly fascinating characters, great people, but neither of them seemed to have liked one another. And then Harry, after she leaves, after the Foysters leave, hires the building and carries out a systematic survey, which goes on for a couple of years, or about 18 months, isn't it? On and off, I can't remember. But it's a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Blue Book period, when he sends people out there with his notes and tells them to investigate the house. So that's the overview of the case for those who are wondering, well, what the hell was Borley Rectory? And then he writes a book which is called The Most Haunted House in England, and that's why it's world famous today.
Okay. So it really
I'll stop talking now.
Based on serious activity that was going on. So what we're going to do is we're going to get it here at the bottom of the hour, CJ.
Yeah, about 3 minutes. Right
three
now.
More minutes, okay. Then what about this Mary Lair, who is supposed to be she's supposed to be the French nun who left the convent and married Henry Waldegrave. And it sounds like perhaps he killed her and buried her. And they're sort of indicating that it's her ghost that's walking around as well.
There's a folk tale that a monk from Bures, which is close by, a convent nearby, possibly Clare, had fled and been captured at Borley and were executed there by the church authorities for breaking their vows.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that masks something later from the Elizabethan period. The Waldegraves were Catholic at a time when Elizabeth had made the country Protestant, and there's all kinds of mysterious comings and goings going on there, and I think there might be... It might be linked to the question of the underground tunnels, which I don't think many people know about. So should we talk about the underground tunnels?
Yeah, we could do that then when we get back. But do you suppose there could have been, like, two stories about nuns and monks and whatnot?
It wouldn't surprise me, because where I come from in Suffolk, there are dozens of stories about monks and nuns. Because it was, as I said, the whole area was ruled by the Abbot of Bury St. Edmunds.
Yeah.
It wasn't ruled directly by the king. It was the Liberty of West Suffolk. And it was ruled by the Abbot of Bury, who had the ability to raise troops and take the taxes.
It must have been a suffocating life, that period of time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think perhaps...
They were robbed of liberties and...
you know, I mean, the English, if English kids can manage to go to boarding school, I didn't, but a lot of them seem to have in the past, and survive that, then being in a monastery was probably nothing, was it?
Okay. Well, why don't we end it right there, and then we can talk about the crypts under the church, or the crypt under the church, and the tunnel that was found, and whatever else.
Okay, there. Also, there ghost were stories as well.
Oh, wonderful. And there were some bones in the cellar that were also found. So we can talk more about that when we come back in a couple of minutes. So don't go away.
Okay, and you are listening to Spirit Radio, the Paranormal Experience. And tonight we are talking to Christian Jensen Roma, better known as CJ. And we're talking about the Bali Rectory, and we will be right back. Supernatural Magazine, one of the UK's top paranormal magazines, provides support to Spirit Radio, the Paranormal Experience. It is the magazine's goal to bring every aspect of supernatural news and research from around the world under one roof to create a universal platform for all those interested in the supernatural. More information is available at supernaturalmagazine.com. And you are listening to Spirit Radio, the Paranormal Experience, on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. To Spirit Radio, the Paranormal Experience, and we are talking about Bali Rectory tonight with Christian Jensen Roma, better known as CJ, and there is an event coming up where you're going to be speaking, CJ, and let's see, that would be February 18th, and it is called Bali Rectory, the Most Haunted House in England, and other supernatural events, I believe. And let's see, CJ is going to be one of the speakers, along with our friend Steve Parsons, Ann Winsper, and Alan Murdy. And this is going to be a Curia live event, and it is going to be live streamed around the world.
So that'd be cool.
Yeah, around the world.
And so, I just wanted to mention that Steve Parsons and Ann Winsper are the co-founders of Parascience. And Steve, of course, is a celebrated paranormal investigator in the UK. And Ann Winsper is one of his colleagues and a parapsychologist who specializes in researching the psychology of electronic voice phenomena. And Mr. Murdy, I don't have a bio on him. Do you know what he does?
Alan Murdy is a committee member of the Society for Psychical Research.
Okay.
He's a barrister. He's a very eminent gentleman, but he's also a very, very senior figure in the UK parapsychological community.
Oh, excellent.
And right. More importantly than that, he grew up in Bury St. Edmunds, round the corner from me.
Oh.
In the same town in Suffolk, just down the road from Bawley. So that's why, yeah, I didn't know him as a child. Well, we had mutual friends, but we didn't really meet till, you know, 30 years later. But
oh,
yeah.
That's very
we
cool.
We both grew up within a few miles of Bawley Rectory.
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, like I said, that event is on February 18th, and you can find all the information you need about that at www.curia, that's K-U-R-I-A.tv/live.
K
Okay.
All right.
And they're going to be, I think they have made a movie on that, and they're going to be showing the trailer at this live streaming event.
Yes.
Yeah. That's very cool. A movie on Borley Rectory. I'd like to see that.
Yeah. My friend Reese Shearsmith told me about it. I've not seen it yet either. I mean, he had something to do about it. I don't know if he narrated it or if he had something to do with the script. But
it hasn't been released, has it, CJ?
No, I don't think so. No. I think it was funded by people raised the funding for it. It was an indie film. What's that strange bleeping noise? Is it at your end? Because it's not a minus.
Bleeping, huh?
No, we're getting humming, but no bleeping.
Who knows? Maybe the men in black are listening.
Maybe.
Sorry.
Ghosts of Borley.
Probably a haunted line.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, perhaps you'd like to tell us a ghost story about the Borley Rectory.
Sure, let's start with one from a lady I knew very well indeed. Her and her friend Joyce had gone out on their bikes. This is 45, 46. So it's after the rectory had burnt down. They were cycling along the road near Belchamps, which is next parish cross. And they'd come up the road from Borley and were cycling along when they said they smelt magnolias. Do you know what magnolias smell like?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Beautiful.
Yeah, a kind of strong scent of magnolias. So they kind of looked around trying to see if there was a lady wearing perfume, but there wasn't. There was just a thick hedge. But as they rode on a bit further, there was a gap in the hedge, and then they said they looked over the field, and there was a brown mass, like a cloud, that was rolling towards them across the field. And as it rolled, it made a rumbling noise, and they felt the smell was coming from that, but the smell became more sickening as they got closer.
Huh.
And they watched it, and they thought, was it some kind of gas, or was it... And then as it got closer, they suddenly panicked and became terrified, and they rode off on their bikes, and they did not stop for anything. And they said it came from the direction of Borley, and they were chased by the cloud, which diverted and followed them across the field.
It followed them?
That's what they said. Now, it sounds like a monster from H.P. Lovecraft or something. I actually think that what they actually encountered, it was my mum who was there with her friend Joyce. She told me the story. It happened to her. So I said to her, well, you know, was it just the wind blowing the sand? Because it's very loose soil there. And I wondered if the wind had just, you know, picked up the soil and blown it. And that was all. They were being chased by a dust storm. But she said, no, she felt it was something evil. So I think she's just a bit superstitious, but that's my first ghost story.
So it was like a brown dust cloud.
Yeah, she said it was like a brown dust cloud that rose up from the ground. It smelt of magnolias, and it kind of rolled across the field. It was like a haystack rolling across the field and chasing them on their bikes. Yeah.
Well, sometimes rotting flesh kind of smells like dead flowers, a sickening, almost a sweet smell.
That was what she said. She said when it got closer, it smelt like fly-blown meat, which means decomposing meat.
See what I mean?
And she said,
yeah.
And she was utterly freaked out. But this happened on. She said there wasn't a wind, and that was why she won't believe me when I say it's just dust being blown on by the wind. She said there was no wind. It was a completely still day. The sky was absolutely deep blue. There wasn't a cloud to be seen, and it was baking hot. And then suddenly this thing just rose up from the field and moved towards them. I don't think I've ever told anyone the story before because it sounds so batty, but, you know, or at least I have.
It doesn't. I mean, it sounds sort of inexplicable, but I don't deny that things like that happen.
There's another odd story, and again, it happened just down the road at Belchamps St. Paul, the crossroads there.
Mm-hmm.
I saw this myself. We were youngsters, and we're trying to find our way to Borley, as we did in those days. We used to go out to Borley and try and hang around the graveyard where there were all kinds of ghost stories. And we took the wrong turning, and actually it was quite funny because we came to a T-junction and the guy in the front said which way, the driver, and I said left, and the other guy said right, and in the end he left it so long he went over the middle and ended up in a field. So we pulled the car out of the field, and we eventually ended up at the crossroads at Belchamps St. Paul. And we parked up the car to try and work out where we were, and started to walk down the lane, and thinking we were going to get to Borley Rectory. And ahead of us, it was like walking through treacle. There was this kind of feeling of absolute syrupy kind of feelings, darkness, seemed thick and tangible. And then suddenly ahead of us, there was a guy on a horse. Oh. And he was clad from head to foot in black. And there was somebody else standing beyond him. And he turned and looked at us. And Axel swears to this day that his eyes glowed. I don't think they did. But we just freaked out because, you know, seeing two strange people standing there in black, one on a horse, one next to them. Anyway, we ran away in terror, jumped in the car. And I think as teenage Suffolk kids, we possibly were, you know, used to bad cars. But the door fell off. The door wouldn't close properly. One of the hinges broke. And then the driver's window fell out and fell down in. And it really was at that point like something out of a horror film.
Oh, my gosh.
So we drove off at incredible speed. And we're driving along. And we finally, we got to Long Melford, which is about 3 or 4 miles away from where we were.
Uh-huh.
And we pull over and there's this huge church there. It's like a cathedral. It's built with wall money in the 15th century when they were very prosperous in the area. We pull up and there are all these gravestones in front of us, a low wall, and we're on a green. And we sit there thinking, okay, we've got away, we're okay, we're okay, we're okay. And then suddenly there's this bang, 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 and it gets louder and louder. And we go, what the hell? And it sounds like it's coming from under the car.
Ooh.
And we all try and get out of the car in panic. And as we're bailing out of the car, the bonnet shoots up. And actually, we found out what it was... There's a thing under an old petrol-driven car, under the oil thing, there's a thing called a sump. Do you know what a sump is?
Sump pump, but not a sump.
The sump in the oil pan?
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The sump. Yeah. What had happened was that as we'd driven down the road in panic, we'd probably knocked it off somewhere, it had fallen off or broken off. But the sump had come off, the oil had drained out, the car was overheating, the radiator had boiled, and then when we pulled the car to a halt... The radiator had heated up to the point where the steam had fired the cap off the radiator, knocking the bonnet up.
So did you walk home? How did you get home?
We were absolutely wetting ourselves in terror. I was only about 19 or 20. We called my parents and called everyone. Everyone called their parents from a payphone. Hi, Mum. I think we just got pursued by demons. Can you come out and pick us up? And my father turned up, and by that time somebody got under the car and said, the sump's gone. Oh, okay. So my father took a look at it and said, you idiots, and drove us home. But there's actually a bit of a weird story here, because I can't look it up because I'm on my phone at the moment. But what I didn't realise was, as a child, I'd grown up near Livermere on a farm next to the one where... M.R. James had grown up, a famous English writer of ghost stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a couple of years later that I first found his works. And because he's another Suffolk lad who wrote a large number of ghost stories that are very famous. One of them is called Count Magnus. And Count Magnus is a vampire story, really. But it ends with the hero being hunted to his death by a horseman and by two figures who catch him at the crossroads at Belchamp St. Paul.
Oh.
So at the exact spot where we saw the picture. But this is a fictional vampire. It's like us being chased by Count Dracula. It makes no sense.
Well, I think there's elements of truth that this author integrated into her story.
His story, yeah.
Emma his James. Story, okay.
Yeah, Montagu, yeah. I mean, he was an expert on folklore. He might have known a story about Horton
yes.
there. He might have incorporated it. Or... It could be, perhaps, that two people, maybe they've been... It's possible. Where I live now in Cheltenham, there's a story. I'll show you how this kind of thing can happen. One day, somebody was doing their driving test. They were driving down the road, the driving test centre at one end, and there's a famous ghost story here about a woman in black holding a handkerchief to her face called the St. Anne's Ghost, and she walks across the road by a house up there. Anyway, they were driving along, and they saw the ghost, the Victorian lady, holding the handkerchief in her face. And they lost control of the car and slammed into the back of a van.
Ooh.
Unfortunately, the van was an outside broadcast van, and the woman, who was an actress, jumped out of the road in terror at nearly getting run over because they were filming a section for a show called Strange But True, I think, on the Cheltenham Ghost. So the actress, dressed as the ghost, caused the accident. You see how it happens?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just bad luck that the person who saw her knew the ghost story and panicked, thinking they were seeing the real ghost, when actually they were seeing the reenactment.
Yeah.
So it's possible that on that night, what we actually saw was just a couple of people dressed up who were, you know, pretending to be the ghosts for some reason.
You know, it's possible, CJ, but what came to mind when you said that, well, did you have a sense of stillness when you saw those two individuals?
Before we saw them, the feeling, we were discussing how unpleasant the feeling was, how it was very, very still. It was very, very stultifying.
Yep.
And we didn't want to go forwards, but we pushed on because we thought it was going to take us where we were going. And we'd left the car and we were walking, and there were about four of us in the car, but only two of us actually pushed forward. And then we saw the two figures, and that was it. We were out of there. We just broke and ran.
Okay, then the author. Well, the author, had the story already been written by the time you saw that?
Oh, 100 years before.
All right, there you go. That's what I think happened.
100 years before, you see.
That was something that people probably perpetually experienced. It was real, and he integrated it into the story. I'm certain of it.
Perhaps. I've never actually tried going back there. Partly because I didn't want to find out what it was. Because when the car fell apart, that was the last straw. So it sounds, as I said, it's more like something from a horror movie. But these events, the two I've described, both occur within a couple of miles of Borley Rectory itself. You know, with a field or so away, you can see where the point was.
It's ancient ground.
It is ancient. In the 1970s, the church itself, though, became famous as the centre of haunting.
Oh.
Because a camera crew from a local television show went there, and on the evening news, I remember watching it as a child, left tape recorders running, and they'd sat up and watched for a while, and then they'd gone outside. But the tape recorders pick up the sound of somebody entering the church and walking up and banging and knocking around. And nowadays they have to lock the church up because so many ghost hunters are fascinated by what happens there.
That doesn't surprise me.
Now, the church is directly across the road,
mm-hmm.
and there are rumours that there was a tunnel, which makes no sense. I can't see why you need a tunnel from the church to the rectory. In the 1860s, if they'd built the tunnel, it would have been recorded, so the tunnel would have been there before the rectory.
Mm-hmm.
But there is definitely a space under the road there, because when they did a recent road survey, they discovered it using the ground-penetrating radar.
Wow.
And it might just be a drainage ditch. It might be a culvert. It might be something ancient.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there are, you know, older cellars. I think Harry Price himself said that the cellars under the rectory were much older than the building above, as if the rectory had been built on an older building.
Yeah.
But there's another story which absolutely fascinates me, which is in the 1970s, a group of East Anglians who were friendly with the vicar, they were ghost hunters. They went there and they discovered that there is a fake grave in the churchyard. It's got a railing around it, but there's no inscription and there's no burial record for it. So they levered it up and there is a flight of stairs that goes down and enters into an underground crypt. And they went down and they found a door and they looked through it. And there are some lead coffins down there.
Ooh.
And there's an altar with some paperwork. And they said they saw some paperwork, an inscription dated 1929, suggesting that it was accessed during the time of the Bulls. But they said that there's a massive crypt and a chapel under the church. Now, Edward Babbs, who was... found out what the relationship was. Babbs wasn't actually the vicar. Babbs was dating the wife of the last vicar who died of Borley. The last vicar, because they've now amalgamated the parish with two others. But he managed to go down there, apparently, and he recorded that, yes, there really is this huge underground crypt. And again, it might have been built by the Waldegraves, but it's fantastic that there is actually, somebody's gone to the trouble of concealing an entrance to a crypt under a fake gravestone. This is something from a horror movie again, isn't it? It's not the kind of thing that happens in real life. It just seems bizarre. But
is there any way
to all they are like that?
Any way to date that crypt or that chapel, that underground chapel?
Well, from the description of it, it must be almost as old as the church. It must have been there for centuries, and one wonders what it was used for.
Yeah.
I mean, why was it? Why would they? And why it was being used in the 20s? I mean, let me look up the passage and read it to you exactly.
And while you're looking for that, were there any graves, any names engraved somewhere?
Well, there's an oddity that Babs claims, which is he said that there are coffins in there. They didn't actually enter the room.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason he said they didn't enter the room is that the church authorities had closed it off because the coffins in the crypt kept moving.
Oh, my. Uh-oh. You left that part out.
Well, there are four lead coffins in there, but every time they go in, the coffins have moved to another position.
Red coffins? That's bizarre. Now,
metal coffins, but I've heard this before. There's a case like this in Barbados.
Yes, I've heard of it.
In Barbados, yeah, the moving coffins.
Yeah.
But there was an earlier version in 1805 at Stanton Church. Now, my friend John Ball, who died this summer, poor old John, lovely geezer, my age, he's a great friend of mine, he died. But he grew up at Stanton Church House. And we used to talk about the story when we were boys, because, you know, we'd stand and sit there as it got dark outside, overlooking the graveyard of the churchyard, thinking, this happened here. There, in 1805, they sealed the vault because the coffins kept moving around the vault. Now, so we know of one case already like that in Suffolk. So whether it was happening as well at...
Sussex.
Yeah, Suffolk. Whether it was happening as well at Borley as it was at Stanton, I don't know. But it sounds like something more vampiric again, doesn't it?
It does,
doesn't it?
Doesn't
like your average ghost story.
And especially since it was red.
Yeah, if you look up Stanton, S-T-A-N-T-O-N, that's the earlier case. Then you've got the Barbados case, and then supposedly the Borley case.
And then Borley is in Sussex, right?
Sorry, Suffolk. Suffolk.
Oh, it's in Suffolk.
Suffolx is further to the south.
Okay.
Different counties. Yeah, Suffolk's in East Anglia. Sussex is south of London. Suffolk is a kind of flat, fairly quiet kind of county. It's right on the border of Essex, which is famous for its witches, and Suffolk.
Okay.
And the Bull family, the actual Bulls who built the rectory, who may not be related to my friend from Stanton.
Yeah.
But they built something else that's really bizarre. They built a brick tower. I'd guess it's about 40, 50 foot high.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows why it was built. It's in a wood, and it was built as a folly, you know, something they just built for the sake of it, really.
Yeah.
And this strange brick tower, you can't go up it anymore because it's in a state of near collapse. It was on private property anyway, but you're walking through the woods, and it's got crenellations, and it's like a castle turret.
Really?
Yeah, and they just built it in the woods, and nobody knows why. It's got a spiral staircase in the inside. You go up, and there's a kind of roof chamber at the top. And I think there were some astrological symbols painted on the roof.
Well, I wonder
if maybe it was built. Maybe it was built as for astrology. Astronomy.
Yeah.
Maybe it was built for some kind of ritual magic. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to suggest a kid's playhouse, but not with the astrological signs in it.
Well, it's more, they might have been chalked on later, but it was more, when I was growing up, it was massive. It's tall.
Wow.
It looks like possibly a water tower. That was the only other thing I could think you might be able to use it for. But it wasn't at the time when I was young, there was no water tank in it.
But
the Bull's Tower in the woods is something that you should Google or have a look at and see if you can find photos of it. Because, again, unless you come from Suffolk, you probably don't know it. It's like the other things I mentioned about the crypt, etc. They're generally not much mentioned.
Do you suppose it was built on a ley line?
I don't know. I'm fairly sceptical about such things. So I don't know. I really don't know. The problem is that Suffolk's got a vast number of churches. I think it might be nearly 300.
Oh, wow.
M.R. James, the ghost story writer I mentioned a while ago, he wrote a book called Norfolk and Suffolk, in which he details all of the churches, and there's just vast numbers of them. Suffolk is sometimes called Silly Suffolk from the Anglo-Saxon word selig, which means holy. Because the number of churches is the greatest anywhere in England.
Well, this tower, do you think it was just built in the style of, say, like maybe the 1400s? It was just a replica?
Yeah. It's a Victorian thing built by the same chap who built the rectory. but rarely mentioned.
Yeah,
it's some distance away. It's a few miles away, but yeah.
What the purpose is. But
yeah, it puzzles me. Why would he build it? You know? The argument it seems to be that he built it because he could, and people used to build follies, which are just for the sake of it.
Yeah. Getting back to that crypt underneath the church, or by the church there, so no one was able to see if any names had been carved on the coffins or any names anywhere down there?
Nobody, according to the people who went down there in the 70s, nobody actually entered the room. It was, the door was locked and they did not break it because that, I mean, this is relying entirely on the word of a group of investigators who went down there.
Mm.
However, Edward Babbs is a very, very respectable guy. Him and Cordia, I mean, they certainly are not the kind of people who would make things up. So if he says it's so, it's so. And the church authorities are apparently aware of it. But if there is a crypt under Borley, then I really think it would require and deserve a proper archaeological investigation. They should get archaeologists to go down there.
Oh, that would be very cool. Does your friend, Dr. Sivia, does he still perform digs and so forth as an archaeologist?
Yes, he does archaeology. He's unwell at the moment, but one of the cases I'm very keen on having him involved with is about 4 or 5 miles across, maybe as much as 7 or 8 miles away, but going back towards Bury and across a bit, there's a place called Bradfield St. George, and on the road between there and Ruffham, which are two little villages, over the years, people have been driving down the road called Kingshall Street, have suddenly noticed on the left, where there's supposedly an empty field, a large house of red brick with flower gardens all laid out and trees growing around it, and it's got a yellow wall and gates, and it's a large manor house, and it's set back from the road.
Mm-hmm.
And they sometimes attempt to drive up to it to see what the house is, or to do a delivery there. My uncle was delivering leaflets, and he turned round because he saw it, but then the house isn't there anymore. It just vanishes. And when it vanishes and when it appears, there's a sudden rush of air. So it seems like a physical object imposing itself in our reality.
So you're talking about a time slip.
Yeah, it's called the disappearing house. And there's one variation on it. A friend of my mother's who she worked with at the West Suffolk Hospital said that she'd seen it a few times, 3 or 4 times. But she said it was a little cottage that she saw, quite a pretty cottage by a small gate.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we were trying to work it out, we suddenly worked out that actually that might be the small cottage at the back of the large house. She was seeing a gatekeeper's cottage. So it was, you know, there's a whole landscape is building itself up and disappearing. And a friend of mine has been doing some work on this for a few years now. But about 20 years ago, me and my friend David Orchid went out there and we paced the ground and we checked the records back to 1805 and we'd not found a house on the spot. Though there's a possibility there was a house there in the 1760s. But when we actually went out and looked in the field, we discovered the remains of an avenue of trees, and eventually we found fragments of red brick, and we're fairly certain that there was actually a house on the spot. And what we dream of doing one day is taking archaeologists out there to investigate.
Oh, yeah, and also the ground-penetrating radar, that might be a help.
Absolutely, absolutely. The only reason we haven't done it at the moment is because there's a group of travellers, gypsies, have camped just around the corner who have a lot of rather loud dogs and who tend to get very agitated whenever we turn up.
Yeah.
Because they think we're there to move them on, which we're definitely not. You know, we're perfectly friendly, but they wonder what we're up to. So,
but just the fact that you discovered some bricks there, does that kind of give you an indication to maybe the period 1700s, 1600s? Would that make any sense?
Yeah. Well, we think it's 18th century. What we found is we were walking down a break of trees, and the revelation that came to us was that there was a break of trees, which is a long wood, and we suddenly realised that spaced evenly apart on either side were pairs of trees, which were much bigger than the other trees. And what it actually is, it's an avenue which had a yellow stone wall on either side of it.
Wow.
And it's filled up with trees over the years, but the oldest trees are those which actually were in the avenue, if you can imagine that. So the other trees have kind of ingrown in between and the whole area. And at the end of it, it just ends, but there's the remains of what appear to be fish ponds to one side.
Oh, my gosh.
And we looked around, and we were fairly sure that there was piping, stone. It's been ploughed over, but we're fairly sure that there is actually an area which isn't ploughed over. And from looking at the pictures on the satellite, we're fairly sure that we found where the house was.
And what town was that again, CJ?
It's between Rougham and Bradfield St. George, south of Bury St. Edmunds, quite close to Borley. I would encourage people who go there to ask the landowner's permission, and also to be careful not to upset the local travellers.
Oh, sure.
You know, they're not doing any harm to us, and we don't intend any harm to them, but they're a bit wary because they get moved on so much.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that is a fascinating tale.
And unfortunately, yeah. CJ, we're out of time.
Darn.
Okay.
All right.
Nice to meet you.
And, of course, CJ is going to be speaking at Borley Rectory, the most haunted house in England, and other hauntings, along with Steve Parsons and Winsper and Ellen Murdy.
Right.
And that is February 18th. And anything else you want to...
live streamed on the internet?
Yep. Anything else you want to mention, CJ, website or anything?
No, you can always, anyone who's interested in the UK can always get a hold of us at asap.ac.uk, www.asap.ac.uk, and I will tell more weird stories of strange Suffolk at this event, I guess.
Oh, wonderful.
All right. Okay.
It's lovely to meet you.
Okay, CJ, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, CJ. We enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Lovely to meet you, as I said. Great. Thank you.
And hang on a minute. Don't go anywhere. You've been listening to Spirit Radio, the Paranormal Experience. And that is it for another week.
And thank you, everyone, for listening, and you have a good evening. You have been listening to Spirit Radio, the Paranormal Experience, with your hosts, Willie Hassel and Lynn Nickerson, on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
In this one of many possible worlds, all for the best, or some bizarre test. It is what it is, and whatever. Time is still the infinite jest. The arrow flies when you dream. The hours tick away, the cells tick away. The watchmaker keeps to his schemes. The hours tick away, they tick away. The measure of a life is a measure of love and respect. So hard to earn, so easily burned. The measure.